This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. You can listen to us on Pacifica Radio and watch us on Free Speech TV. Americans are overworked, underpaid, stressed, mostly non-unionized. We may lack health care or pay too much for it. We may pay through the nose for child care and often live paycheck to paycheck, just one calamity away from total bankruptcy. Now, that's the story for most of us 99%ers. The 1%ers, on the other hand, are swimming in millions and billions of dollars, get the best healthcare money can buy, own multiple homes and yachts, gold-plated bathroom fixtures, and send their kids to the best universities and get out of paying taxes. But in other parts of the world, such a depressing order has become a thing of the past. In Scandinavian countries in particular, like Norway, Sweden, Finland, and Denmark, people are healthier, get paid more, work fewer hours, have paid vacations, affordable childcare, and more compared to us Americans. What do the Scandinavians get so right that we get so wrong here in the U.S.? And how can we get what they have? My guest, George Lakey, is here to answer those crucial questions. George Lakey is the former Eugene M. Lang Visiting Professor for Issues and Social Change at Swarthmore College. He's led more than 1,000 workshops all over the world and been involved in activist projects at the local, national, and international level. He now joins me to discuss his new book. It's called Viking Economics, How the Scandinavians Got It Right and How We Can Too. Welcome to the program, George.
I'm glad to be here.
So first, it wasn't always this way in places like Norway. There was a time when inequality was so bad, the economy was so bad, people would emigrate out of those countries, come to places like the U.S. What was the depressing order in countries like Finland and Norway, et cetera? And what sorts of policies did they start to take on that completely changed things around in just a few decades?
Yes, it was really terrible, which is why they were almost hemorrhaging, you could say, their own population coming to Canada, coming to the US and other countries. And so it was a very big turnaround. And that was part of the attraction for me in researching the book. I'd experienced their contemporary, you know, situation by living there and working there. And then I got very curious when I found out what a wreck things were 100 years ago, about how they could change things around. And the critical thing about that was that they pushed that 1% of their population, that economic elite, out of dominance so that they could open the space for a different model, which is what the economists call the Nordic economic model. And in that model, the one that they have now, they actually put workers first rather than putting the entrepreneurs first. Now, it turns out, to my surprise, when I did the research, I discovered that by creating an economic order that puts workers and their own productivity and their own worker satisfaction first, they actually made it better for entrepreneurs as well. And so there are more startups in Norway per capita, for example, than there are in the United States. Very surprising stuff I learned over there.
So, of course, we would all like to see our elites pushed out of political and economic power, too. And when I say we, I mean progressives. Sadly, there's a whole sector among working class conservatives who think that if you put the businessmen in charge, the billionaires in charge, they will come and save the working class, which I just really never understood. But how do we progressives who see the elites as the problem get them out of power? Today they have a stranglehold on our economy and because they have a stranglehold on our political system through the money that they spend. It seems like an unwinnable situation.
Well, there were several things that they did that I think would also work for us. One thing they did was developed a vision of what they wanted instead of their miserable lot. And that vision was such that it sounded practical to people. It was a common sense vision that they were able to get broad agreement in the population. They were able to get a majority of people behind this vision. So in other words, it wasn't a matter of let's protest this, protest that, protest the other thing. Instead, it was let's go for a vision of what could be different. And then having gotten a tremendous lot of support for that, they then created mass movements to press for that vision. One part of the mass movement's work was developing co-ops, cooperatives, worker cooperatives, consumer cooperatives, alternative insurance companies, alternative banks, all kinds of cooperative institutions that gave the people the confidence, yes, we could actually direct society. We don't really need the economic elite to run the economy for us because we actually have the competence and the skills and the smarts to be able to do that. But then the other thing that was really important for them was to develop the power, the coercive power, to throw the 1% out, not to destroy them, but to push them out of dominance.
We're not talking about French-style revolution. We're talking about nonviolent revolution.
Nonviolent revolution. That's what we're talking about. They actually made their society ungovernable by the economic elite. And when the economic
Well, what do you mean by that? Ungovernable meaning how? Did they just, because you pointed out that protest doesn't always get us to where we want to go. No, how did they make it ungovernable?
Protest is too negative. What they did was they said, we're going to non-cooperate with what you expect us to do. For example, you expect us to work, we'll go on strike. So they had massive numbers of strikes. In fact, the thing that made a difference in Sweden in 1931 was a general strike throughout the entire country. And when people absolutely refused to go to work, there's no way you can, of course they called out the troops. They called out the troops and fired on people. They killed people and so on. You can always, if you're running a government, you can always come up with some repressive measures, right? But the thing is, if people refuse to work, then the economy grinds to a halt. And that is an immense source of power. Another thing you can do is fill the streets. You can occupy and so on. These are things that the Americans understand because it was the kind of thing that we were doing in the 60s quite well and forcing an enormous lot of change, forcing centuries of racial oppression that was legalized in the Deep South to have to break apart. Didn't take care of all the racism, that's for sure, because the movements of the 60s did not then take the next step and take on the economy. That's what's waiting for our generation.
Right. But and of course, we know that visionaries like Martin Luther King Jr. had, before he was assassinated, expanded his vision to see economic justice as intimately linked with racial justice. Go ahead. Mm-hmm.
He had become a democratic socialist by then, stirred by, among other things, one of his right-hand people, a guy named Bayard Rustin, who influenced me a lot. That was my first movement, actually, but participating was the first time I was arrested was in the civil rights movement. And I came under the influence of this guy, Bayard Rustin, who kept explaining to Dr. King why democratic socialism was absolutely essential if we were to get rid of racism. And Bayard turned out to be right.
Let's talk about a little bit more of what the Scandinavians enjoy today so that we can see the end game for what we Americans might be able to achieve. Because, of course, when we think about mass general strikes, it's very frightening. I mean, people are already living paycheck to paycheck, living with so much job insecurity. There's fear, on an individual level that if you join a strike, you would lose your job. It's hard enough for unions to hold on to the few union jobs that we have. So let's talk about the end goal. Today in Finland, say, or in Norway, for example, what are the sorts of things that people can live with and enjoy? Say somebody, and here's one thing that I found really interesting in your book. They have a really interesting immigration policy. So how would a new immigrant coming to a country like Norway, what would he or she face?
One of the people I interviewed was an immigrant from Burundi. Who told me that he sat down with a government worker, this is standard, and the government worker said, we offer you a deal. We will pay you a living wage in return for your spending that year learning Norwegian language, learning our culture, developing a job skill that is marketable in our country. Maybe you're terrific at X and Y in Burundi, but maybe we don't have that kind of job. So you need to develop job skills for our country. And you need to agree to be placed in a part of Norway where we want you to be. And after a year's time, when you've learned the language, the culture, you've lived in this new place, and you've developed the job skills, then you're free to settle in the country wherever you want to and go right to work. So it was a very self-respecting kind of contract.
Of course, that sort of thing costs money. But here in the U.S., we take the money that we might spend on something like this and lock up an immigrant, put them in detention for years and years, and then spend money to deport them. I mean, okay, so that's what an immigrant coming to Norway would face. And I only put that question out there ahead of time because I know there's some people thinking about leaving the United States because of the election. But okay, so what about people, once an immigrant is settled there, or a native Norwegian, lived in the country, they get married, they might have children, they have a job. What's the sort of jobs that are available, and what are the sorts of salaries, job security, childcare, education for children, etc., that's available? What is life like for a Norwegian?
Well, Norwegians don't believe in low salaries. They believe in high wages. So, and so do the other Nordic countries. Like in Denmark, in Copenhagen, if you work for McDonald's, you get $20 an hour. That's your minimum.
$20 an hour? $20 an hour. They're paid way more than our McDonald's workers are paid.
Sorry?
They're paid way more than our McDonald's workers are paid.
Way more. The whole wage scale is much higher, except at the top end, where it's very, very tough in a place like Norway or Sweden or Denmark to become a millionaire, much less a billionaire. It's possible, but it's unlikely, because the big emphasis is on livable wages rather than on wealth being sucked up, you know, as in vacuum cleaners to the top. And one way that they make sure to institutionalize that is through the taxation system, so that the taxation system is rigged so that it's very hard to be highly wealthy. And on the other hand, it's virtually impossible to be poor. Most people have a standard of living that makes it easy for them to save to go to Spain in the winter, because those winters are hard up in the northern countries, and to have a good life.
Well, I mean, this just sounds utopian.
It feels like
there's a lot of ideological barriers that we face here in the United States, right? Because it seems as though even for somebody who's making minimum wage, if you tell them you might never be able to be a millionaire, but you might get a living wage. Sadly, we have people who prefer to see a country where it is possible for millionaires to be millionaires, even if that particular individual has almost no chance to lift themselves out of poverty, enter even the middle class, let alone become a millionaire. I mean, it feels like we've been like massively brainwashed by capitalists.
That's right. We have been massively brainwashed. And at the same time, if you really offered people a choice, look, you can stay in poverty and wish you were a billionaire. Or on the other hand, you could join this movement that will enable you to live not in poverty, but in fact to live with the experience of abundance, to have terrific healthcare, no matter what the healthcare, your own medical needs turn out to be, you can have that healthcare assured to you. You will have pension, because pension is universal. It's not attached to the workplace itself, but it's a universal provision. You can have affordable child care for the children. In fact, you get a child allowance to support your children, to make it easier for them. And you free higher education, free job training. Let's say that your job gets very boring for you when you're 45 years old. You really wish you could do something else. Well, that is encouraged in the Nordic countries. They say, good, try another job. We offer you free training, so you have job skills for another job. You want to go to university at that point, you're 45, no problem, do it. Go to med school, go to law school, do what you want to do, because we know that worker productivity in our societies is promoted by people wanting to do the work rather than feeling forced to do the work.
Sadly, of course, the politicians that are beholden to moneyed interests in this country have convinced people to view such things as handouts from the government, as, you know, basically a bunch of people getting a free ride, and that the hard work, the value and virtue of hard work is what we Americans value, even though today we live in a country where no matter how hard you work, you can't even, you know, barely eke out an existence. I want to turn to chapter 12 of your book, George, which I thought was really interesting. It sounded like, of course, Scandinavian countries are a utopia, but of course that can't be true. They do face challenges today. One of the challenges that you talk about is the issue of race, and you have a chapter on race. Obviously, there's a lot of immigration happening to Europe today because of some of the wars that the European Union and the US have made worse. What are those challenges in Scandinavia, and what would you like to see happen there?
Yes, I was very puzzled at first about why there was racism in those countries, because they didn't have centuries of slavery as the United States has had. And I sat down with the director of the Anti-Racism Center in Oslo. It's very common for the government to support anti-racist work in those countries. And asked her, where does the racism come from? And she said, George, you are, of course, aware of the slave trade with regard to your own country, but have you considered who built those ships? Those ships, some of those, many of those ships were built by Norwegians and built by Swedes and Danes. And so whenever you participate in something like the slave trade, you dehumanize the cargo to make it okay, to justify the fact that you're earning your money from slavery. And so that hangs over, and there is in the white population in our countries still some residual racism. And then that gets triggered by immigration from Africa and Asia and so on. And we need to constantly work to unlearn the racism that comes down in a kind of cultural DNA that we've inherited. The one thing we have as an advantage, though, as we work to unlearn racism, is we have an economic system that totally is behind the immigrants who come here moving upward. So they're not sort of penned into ghettos. In fact, it's hard, very hard. I tried very hard to find substandard housing in Norway, and I couldn't find it because they don't believe in having slums. They only believe in having decent housing, and they believe in job skills being available through free training programs and free university and so on. So that means that the immigrants to those countries, Sweden and the rest, have this tremendous opportunity to assimilate into the larger society and also to get the job skills and the economic background that will help.
So any communities that they form are more voluntary than forced. So let's finally talk about how obviously there's no one size fits all, right? I mean, these are models that worked for the Nordic countries. These economic gains are really, really powerful, but the way they got there may have worked for them. How do you foresee? Let's wrap up this conversation. And there is much more to talk about, but people can get your book to discover it. We are today on the cusp of a very serious climate catastrophe. Do you foresee us restructuring our economy to be more in alignment with the environmental values we desperately need here and the economic justice needs in this country? Because it feels like those two things do need to be linked as well.
And they are very linkable. In fact, you can really tell in the Scandinavian countries that they are racing ahead in addressing climate issues because they've handled the economic justice issues as well as they have. We can follow their example. And that does mean, though, pushing out the 1%'s dominance, because the 1% is not on the side of addressing climate change in a proper way, and is certainly not on the side of economic justice. So we can learn from the Scandinavians. You're quite right. It's not a blueprint. It's not something we can automatically adapt. But on the other hand, I always like to learn from people who've done something well, and maybe my style will be a little different, but I can still learn something from someone who's doing something well, rather than just come up with my own invention and then find that it's not working all that well.
Well, George, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, and thanks for taking the trouble to research and write this book. It certainly seems like a really great starting point for envisioning what we here in the U.S. could achieve. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
George Lakey is the former Eugene M. Lang Visiting Professor for Issues in Social Change at Swarthmore College, and we have been talking about his new book, Viking Economics, How the Scandinavians Got It Right and How We Can Too. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. We're also on Twitter at twitter.com/ruwithsonali.